We're on a towboat called the Silver Bullet, going up and down the Missouri River with Jay Rudy for the Army Corps of Engineers.
We're going to get a closer look at a dike and revetment.
It's so easy to forget that the Missouri River is engineered. In the 1940s, Congress mandated the Corps to install dikes and revetments. Those are piles of rocks or other materials that direct sediment and water flow. They give the river its physical shape. The Corps designed the part of the river that goes through Kansas City to be a navigation channel for barges. But there are a lot of ideas out there about how the river should be used. Technically, the river only has 7 other authorized purposes. Weird, right? They are flood control, hydropower, water supply, water quality, recreation, fish and wildlife — that's one official purpose, fish and wildlife — and irrigation. But as you've moved through the city or driven along the river, have you dreamed up uses for the Missouri other than the 8 official ones? We want to hear your vision for the Missouri River at 816-235-2888 on KCUR's Central Standard. That's 816-235-2888. And no idea is too crazy to share. At least, I don't think it is. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me now is reporter Suzanne Hogan here at KCUR, who's been looking into the actual future of the river. She's the one who went for a ride in that tugboat, the Silver Bullet, with the Army Corps of Engineers. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Gina. Good morning.
When you started your reporting, what was it you wanted to know about the future of the Missouri River?
Well, as a person who's from Kansas City and who has always been really fascinated with the Missouri River, I just have really vivid memories of going to St. Louis and watching the Mississippi River with friends growing up, and watching barge traffic. And as I have gotten down to the Missouri River more and explored areas down there, I just kind of started to think, man, why aren't there more barges on this river? And that was really the main question that, you know, led me down an 8-month spiral of research.
And I'm going to come back to barges really shortly, but we just heard about 8 authorized uses for the Missouri River. I never quite realized that such a thing existed. Who determines what is and isn't authorized on the Missouri River?
And those are Army Corps of Engineer terms, and that came out of an act of Congress out of 1944 and with the flood, the 1944 Flood Act. So it's kind of a complicated history. It's called the Pick-Sloan Project. It was these two characters who had conflicting ideas about, what they thought the Missouri River should be used for: irrigation, navigation, you know, all these different things. And basically in 1945, they came up with a compromise, and that mandated those 8 authorized purposes. That's the very quick summary of that.
So what's the relationship between the purposes? I mean, since all 8 are authorized, can we basically do anything and everything that arguably fits in one of those categories? Like, we could have a robust fishing community along the river and also develop the river for navigation while also controlling floods? Or are some of them at odds with one another?
I believe that the Corps would say that all of those things, yeah, you should be able to do all of those things equally. It is a balancing act. But the thing is, inherently, all those things do conflict, you know, like right when the bank stabilization and navigation project, which was like a 40-year-long project which in my story, if anybody heard of it, I can kind of briefly sum that up. It basically designed the river from Sioux City to St. Louis to be the channel that it is, basically designed for barges. But the thing is about that, you know, that took 40 years to make, you know, from 45 to 1980. And right at about 1980, 1981, you had the Corps themselves and, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service starting to look at some of the environmental impacts that that had. Things that, like, people, you know, over time, people's understandings of things change. And I think what happens is sometimes things get implemented, and then, you know, you, in some ways, I hate to say, you know, you learn as you go. So that's an example of a time when that has conflicted, you know, and it took so many years for certain changes to be made to the plan. A biological opinion was issued by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the Corps did adapt, and then they changed the river a little bit to be more aware of some of these environmental concerns. But I think that, to get back to your question, I mean, ideally, yes. I mean, you should be able to do
legally.
Legally, yes. And, you know, and I think it's one thing about this, it's like the Missouri River, people, like, you know, I kept coming across, like, the upper basin from Sioux City to St. Louis. You know, they fragmented it up state by state. There's all these different interests, but really it is a whole river system, and everything kind of affects everything else. And then don't forget, obviously, it feeds into the Mississippi. It's huge. You know, it feeds in a huge way to the Mississippi, and that is also a way that it's connected. So it's kind of hard to think about balancing all these things, all these conflicting and complementary things, and then remember at the same time that it's also a part of a much larger system as well.
Yeah. Well, so if we can, we legally can have it all, but we sort of in within the realities of the natural world, we kind of can't have it all on some level. So we have to make choices is basically what it comes down to. Is that something that creates some tension?
I think so. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think, like, for example, in the early 2000s, there was a drought, you know, and there, this played out in a very real way. You know, the Corps authorizes flow support for navigation from the beginning of April through December, or through November for barges. But the thing is, and that's coming from reservoirs in the upper basin. And there was a conflict between the states and the upper basins and the Dakotas, where they were basically like, well, we don't want to just, like, release all that water. We want the water up here for recreation and their fish spawning areas. And it, you know, there have been cases, court cases that went to court, you know, like the Corps is always kind of in a lot of different litigation battles. And what eventually ended up happening, you know, they did released a lower flow support for, it wasn't as deep of a channel. And, you know, what happened was a lot of navigators and towboat operators started to be like, you know, this river isn't that reliable, and it kind of pushed people off. And now you're seeing, you know, 7 years later, people are trying to make that push back again, but people still kind of say that, well, the water's not there, but the water is there now, you know, it's just a perception thing.
All right. So if you had to choose, if you can't have everything on the Missouri River and you have to focus on one thing, you get to decide what it is, what do you pick and why? 816-235-2888. Let's hear from Bruce in Liberty. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can you share?
I have utilized a number of the rivers in Missouri and Arkansas for floating and fishing. I have friends, we've floated on pontoons on the Missouri and the Mississippi, staying overnight as we went along. And it looks like to me the Missouri as a whole, and I don't speak from any knowledge whatsoever other than my own experiences, but they use the Missouri recreationally in other areas, and there's other large rivers in the United States used recreationally. And when you look at the so small amount of barge traffic on it, I would like to see the Corps try to look at a more of a recreational focus. And I know they say recreation, but when you've been to other areas and used the rivers, it's just like a muddy trough, and it is, you don't feel safe. And I realize there's some fishing on it and some duck hunting possibly, but, and I know flood control for the farmers out in the bottom is important, and I appreciate that. But if they can figure out ways to use other rivers, large rivers throughout the United States, recreationally, and also allow the flood control, I'd like to see the Corps try to focus on that.
Well, thanks, Bruce. You know, we're going to talk more about recreation in a little while, but this whole idea of the Missouri being like a muddy trough is pretty interesting. That's nothing new. I mean, Mark Twain wrote about that.
Yeah, definitely. But, and I think it's not, from the way that it's been designed in this lower basin area from Sioux City to St. Louis, it's not, the way the sediment flows, it's not as muddy as it used to be, which is kind of interesting. But I think the Corps would say is that talking to a lot of people who work in the Corps, you should be able to have barges and recreation. I mean, it's not like one or the other.
I want to talk to you about barges. It sounds like industry is probably a large part of where things are headed. And we put this inquiry out to a network of citizen sources, just regular people who have joined what we call our Tell KC network, to give us their perspective on local issues. And lots of people in that network told us that the view of the river is important to them. And that's that is how so many people interact with the river in their daily lives, by seeing it. They're not like wading in it or something. So when you imagine seeing barges on the river, a lot of people express that that's what they want to see from downtown Kansas City. Does that appeal to you, Suzanne?
Oh, definitely. Well, I think that's a thing. Every time I go hang out by the river, or, you know, or I'm driving across a bridge and I see a boat or anything on the river, I mean, I'm always kind of looking. It's like, oh, that's like, what's going on down there? But even when I went to Little Rock, Arkansas recently, and we went to the Big Dam Bridge, and which is
a funny name.
I know, I like it, but I really had to work that into the script. there was a bunch of barges being pushed by a towboat through a lock and dam, and on the Big Dam Bridge, you know, there was so many people, you know, running, kids, babies, you know, like, I mean, because it's a great recreational spot and a way for people to connect. But so many people, as these barges were getting pushed through, stopped and watched, because it's interesting. It's just kind of interesting to see how things move. You don't really get to think about that as much, I guess.
Well, it was kind of funny to us how many people mentioned barges in their notes to us about it. So, you know, people really want to look out on the water and see barges. So as we were sitting around trying to figure out why that might be, our producer, Matthew Long Middleton, shared a theory that I think is really interesting. So I've invited him out of his usual spot in the producer's booth to come share it. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Gina.
I'm so excited that our listeners are going to get to know this side of you. Tell me why you think people want to see barges on the water when they look out on the river.
So I thought about this a lot last night, I would say that a lot of my thinking is informed by Christopher Alexander, who, if you know me, know I'm kind of obsessed about. But like, I kind of see
he's an author.
Yeah, he's an author, architect, also computer programmer. If you have time, pick up A Pattern Language. It changed my life. Also just, you know, a bunch of other things. So I was thinking about it, and I was thinking like, water itself, we obviously have like a deep connection to, right? Like we ourselves are mostly water. We come from water. It has a lot of power, like quite literally. It is power incarnate when we think about
that it moves things.
Well, not only that it moves things, but it is the embodiment of power. Like a particle of water has more potential energy up in Missouri than it does down in, you know, the Gulf of Mexico. Like there is power being, it's unfolding in front of you. So like and because of that, I think that there's like it's not a surprise that rivers and bodies of water are like imbued with like religious significance, you know, the Ganges River, baptism. And because it's like, because of this power, it's a little bit of the other, it's a little bit outside of us and out and unknowable to us. And so to like be in proximity to it is kind of a way of connecting to that otherness, this thing that, you know, transforms mountains into, you know, into canyons over
time. When
you
say otherness, in this case, do you kind of mean like something bigger than yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, yeah, something beyond oneself, something that's powerful and like that. So like water has that kind of like, you know, symbolic and psychological kind of power over us. But, you know, I think the other big thing that I really think about is we just love to watch people work. And I think this is true, especially with children. I think you mentioned that, Suzanne, like kids running around watching the barges. But like when you watch someone work, you're actually watching. It's a very rudimentary story, but it's a story that's unfolding. It has a beginning, middle, and end. And it has a character, usually one or several people, who are trying to overcome an obstacle. Will the barge make it up the lock? Right. Like you have to there's a beginning, middle, and end to that story, and you watch it unfold. And moreover, like when we watch people work, when we watch things happen, we also get connected to beyond ourselves again. We get outside of ourselves in the sense that, like, you can watch a barge and you can say, that's how I am here. You know, that fertilizer that's being transported into this community is going to become the food I eat. You know, if you watch like a mechanic work on a car as you're passing by, like that's how that happens.
So when we say we want to see barges on the river, I mean, a lot of people might be feeling that for different reasons. But in a way, it sounds like we're saying we want to look out on the river and see ourselves. We want to see humanity.
Yeah, I think that that's a really big part of it. We want to see us kind of both like be a part of and fight nature, but all at the same time, I think. And there's this kind of like weird yin and yang to that experience. And I know that I wish we had more of it in this community.
Well, thanks, Matthew.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Gina.
I'll catch you at work.
You'll catch me in 2 seconds behind the glass.
Yeah. Suzanne, is the human presence on the river, which barges in some way probably do represent, is that at odds with any of the other uses of the river?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think a lot of environmental groups, well, in particular, the Missouri Coalition for the Environment, which is the one I spoke to for my story, Brad Walker, a lot of people are frustrated with at what cost this channel was created for barges that really haven't been moving tonnage in the way that they've said that they were going to, like the projected amount. I mean, we're moving like 500,000 tons right now. That's like nothing compared to other big waterways. And
but you say at what cost? What is the cost?
Well, the cost being for the way the river naturally used to be, you know, like when they created the structures that actually physically shaped how the river flows, you know, a lot of natural habitat that was along the riverbanks changed, and a lot of it had an environmental impact that is irreversible in a lot of ways. And I think that frustrates a lot of environmental groups, and, you know, at the expense of taxpayer dollars. And so that's something I don't know. I think that there's no like movement to change that. But I think that's something that miffs a lot of people. And that's not to say that the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies aren't working on environmental improvements, but it's just kind of, you know, some irreversible things happened when they created those structures too.
We have another perspective now. Rick Oswald is a farmer. He's with us by Skype from the Fairfax-Langdon area in Missouri. And Rick, you got in touch with us when we put out this inquiry to share a farmer's point of view. How close is your farm to the river?
Well, I live just north of Langdon, Missouri, and my farm is in the Missouri River Valley. I live on the river bottom, and that's kind of west of Rockport. So I was born here in the house where my folks started their marriage, and it's the only place I've lived. And I've experienced 3 floods on the Missouri River, one in 1952, one in 1993, and one in 2011. So I've actually seen the river flow through the front yard of my house more than once.
When this winter there was some flooding on the Missouri River, did that affect you?
No. This year I thought that I agreed with the river management and the way it was handled, because after 2011, I think a lot of people came to understand the importance of letting some of that water out of those lakes as they start to fill, rather than wait until they're full to overflowing and then just cutting it loose. We were flooded here in 2011 for over 3 months, and wow, that was how long I was away from my home. And that was many times longer than the other 2 floods. In 52 and 93 both, the floods lasted about 3 weeks. It was a matter of the river coming up, the river breaching the levee and filling the river bottom with water and then draining back down, so that we were back home in about 3 weeks. So
when you're forced to evacuate for 3 months and your livelihood comes from the land, that it's not just leaving your home, it's leaving your business. How does that affect you?
Well, that was very difficult. It's difficult anytime it happens, even if it's just what we would call a regular flood rather than what we had in 11. But, you know, there's more involved. Sure, I lost a crop, and I was kept away from my home. A lot of people lost their homes because it was such a severe flood. But it's a lot of work leading up to the flood, because we do have warning. And the Corps of Engineers does say things that let you know what's coming, or you know, give you a hint. So it means you have to move all your possessions, everything you have, all your machinery, grain stored in grain bins, furniture, animals. And everything has to find a new home until the water subsides and it can all come back again.
Is there something that you like about the Missouri River as it is now?
Well, the river that I see now is the river that I've always known. It's the only river I've ever known. And I used to fish on the banks with Dad. And back in the 1950s, I'm fairly old, so in the 50s and early 60s, my dad would take me fishing. We'd sit on the riverbank, and there would be pretty steady procession of barges up and down the river. It wasn't unusual to see them. The only inconvenience to us was we had to bring in our lines as they went by because we might risk losing our bait. But we coexisted with that. And things have changed to a certain extent now because it's an aging river system and the flood controls are aging. So there's not the capacity between the levees anymore to contain that excess flow of water that we see sometimes when we have a flood like that. And that's one of the things that makes river management a little more difficult.
You pointed out in your note that you sent to us that there seemed to you, unless I've misinterpreted, feel free to correct me, that there's an unfairness in the difference between how the river is managed around urban areas and how it's managed where it flows through rural areas.
Well, there is. You know, I come to Kansas City quite often, and I think I never cease to marvel at the work that's been done to contain the river right there in the Kansas City area around North Kansas City and on.
And to prevent flooding in the city.
Well, yeah, the amazing structures. I mean, the size of the levees and the drainage systems put in place to get the water out of those industrial parks. And then I look out here in the country and I hear a lot of people, environmentalists and recreationists, say that we need to return to a wild river out here where I live. And yet we control what I think is one of the most valuable assets in Missouri and in the world, and that's fertile farmland with an abundant supply of water. And if there's anything that's worth preserving in this time of increasing population, where we know the world is going to need more food in the coming years, it's this kind of land. We deserve that same kind of protection here, not because we have industry that compares to what you have in Kansas City, but because we have this very basic industry of food production.
So how is it that it sounds like you see farmers being kind of at odds with a lot of the ideas floating around out there about the river? And I did not mean that pun. That was an accident. I'm really sorry. But how would it be that, say, recreation or conservation would be at odds? Can you explain that with the protection of farmland?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people come here and they see this broad valley, because the river valley here where I live is at least 5 miles wide. I can see Nebraska from my kitchen window. So it stretches from the Los Hills on my side of the river in Missouri over to the bluffs where Nebraska actually starts on the other side of the river. And they see this broad area, and a lot of folks imagine it all growing up in cottonwood trees and prairie grass. But the Corps of Engineers and the Department of Conservation and Fish and Wildlife have done a lot of work. They've purchased a lot of farmland and taken that farmland off the tax rolls of some of these rural counties, which has really hurt them. And they've tried to do things there that would make places for people to come and hunt and do the things they want to do. So the opportunities are there. I think there's a disagreement over how much of that there ought to be. And I think there needs to be some realistic acknowledgement of the fact that not everyone's going to take advantage of it. There are a few people who will drive the 2 hours from Kansas City to come up here and camp and do things. But most folks in Kansas City want to do things a little closer to home. So we don't see, even with the improvements that the Corps and Department of Conservation have made as far as recreation are concerned, we don't see a huge influx of people.
I'm going to jump in. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a paddler who, not surprisingly, does want recreation on the river, and from you, 816-235-2888. Don't go away.
Let the rain drive right on, let the waves sweep along, 'cause I got them deep river blues.
Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're sharing our big ideas about what the Missouri River could be someday if we were in charge. I've been chatting with reporter Suzanne Hogan, who's looked into what the actual plans are for the future of the river, and farmer Rick Oswald. Now let's hear quickly from a paddler, and then we'll get to you. Mandy Urban, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi there.
So you are a two-time competitor in the MR340, which is a paddling race from Kansas City to St. Louis, and you have identified yourself as a river enthusiast. In what way are you a river enthusiast?
Any chance I can get, I pretty much spend my time there. So I eat, sleep, think river.
Where does your love of the river, the Missouri River in particular, or just water in general, come from?
I don't know. I didn't start paddling until about 10 years ago. And once I started, I just couldn't get enough. I don't know where it comes from other than I just connected the minute I got on it.
What is it like to experience the river from a paddle boat in the daytime, at nighttime? I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners have never experienced it that way.
The first time I set out on the Missouri River solo, I was confident. I was excited. My mom dropped me off and I looked at her and I said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm about to do this." And then she was scared. It's big. It's really mighty. It's really massive. During the day, it's just you and the water and the sunshine and whatever else you want to look at or take in. At night, it is probably close to the most magical thing I've ever experienced. You're on a river that's wider than you can imagine. And, you know, I could scream or shout and nobody would be around to hear me. The stars.
So that's something that sounds really exciting to some people and maybe terrifying to others, but please go on about the stars.
The stars. Oh, there's a million. you hear nature. You hear what the river sounds like at night, which a lot of people don't experience. Owls from everywhere. One of my experiences is a tree fell, and not every day do you get to hear what that sounds like. But being in the river and in the middle of nowhere, you know, you heard every sound.
Well, so if you were to have a dream for the Missouri River that, you know, something that could be pursued actively, what would it be?
I don't know, because listening to the interviews that you've done with people so far, it's really interesting. Because I understand flood control, I understand recreation, I understand even adding commerce to the river. So I guess a dream would be, how can we meet all of those 8 points without one of them overstepping the other? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Suzanne Hogan, as a reporter who's looked into this stuff, that does sound like, you know, pursuing a win-win situation for everyone would be awesome. Is there something objectively preventing us from doing that, or is it just hard?
I mean,
I think it's just difficult trying to get all those different components to come together and mesh well.
Let's hear from Suzanne Hogan.
I mean, there's so many diverse stakeholders, and it's like the Corps's been coming up a lot. The Corps tries to have meetings. It is for not of lack of effort of trying to get people to come together and talk about their interests. And I mean, it's just how do you make everybody happy? I mean, this the age old question. I mean, I guess it's not much of an answer, but I think ideally everybody would like it to all balance out and work out, but that's just not how I think what Brad Walker said for the Missouri Coalition for the Environment. At times things just, some of those authorized purposes are in conflict with each other, and it just takes compromise to make it work.
Rick Oswald, it sounds like you know, Mandy, our paddler, our recreation enthusiast on the Missouri River, has heard you and understands that what you want from the river is flood control for your livelihood and for the benefit of people having food that comes from agriculture. Do you, when you hear her description of what it's like to paddle on the river and to be out on the river enjoying nature, does that resonate with you at all?
Sure it does. Yeah, I think it is. It's a great resource. It's an amazing thing to look at. And the majesty of that river and the the threat of that river. When you're like I am, where I am, and I've watched those levees overflow. I've watched 2 feet of water come over that Missouri River levee and flow constantly across the bottom until that levee breached. And I've seen that happen, and it's awesome and it's scary. And I think people should go out and become acquainted with the river, and I think they should enjoy it. It's a wonderful resource. But you had a caller earlier named Rick who made a comment about it being a muddy trough. And I just want to point out that that was one of the aspects of the Missouri River way back when Lewis and Clark found it, was that it was a muddy river because it wasn't controlled and it flowed from bluff to bluff. And there isn't a square foot of my farm that that river hasn't flown through sometime over the last few thousand years. So it does take management and control, or it's unmanageable for everyone. And really that would damage people's opportunities to actually enjoy the river if we're allowed to just go free.
Well, I want to get back to these ideas that we're digging into right now, but let's hear from one of our callers who has what he thinks are some zany ideas for the future of the river. We've got Bill in Kansas City with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are your ideas?
Well, I was driving to work, and as I was driving to work, I was passing by the downtown airport. So, I mean, it was perfect. I was able to look at. And so a couple of my zany ideas is that the installation of helical turbines in
what
the river.
Are those?
Helical turbines are basically, they're turbines that would catch the movement of the water, rotate in circles, and then generate electricity. Helical turbines are being used out on the coasts and areas to take advantage of wave movement to spin the top, if you will, to
so
generate
like,
electricity.
So we've all heard about solar powered energy. This would be just the water powered version of that same idea.
Absolutely, yeah. It'd be hydropower, but it wouldn't require a dam.
Well,
so
cool.
That's one zany idea. The other zany idea is to take advantage of the invasion by the Asian carp and create a fisheries type of area on the Missouri River to extract those carp and then process them. And evidently there's markets in the Asian countries for that meat. And right now I've heard that there are actually fisheries being developed on the Mississippi River on the St. Louis side. So those are my two zany ideas. The other thing I wanted to point out is that today is the first open house in Parkville, Missouri, the city of Parkville, to take comments on their updating their parks plan. And portions of the comments are asking about improving the interaction with the river. So that's something that people could take advantage of. Then I'm kind of rambling, but if you're going to allow me one more thought.
One more quickly.
Okay. The commercial barge traffic on the Missouri River, I'm also a Missouri River paddler. I've dodged those barges, and they've given me some gray hairs in places. But I've often wondered, and maybe this goes to your reporter, Ms. Hogan, what plans are in place for emergency response and emergency response funding should one of those barges carrying fertilizer or hydrocarbons or other types of things take a dump in the river? And what's coming across my radar right now in thinking about this is that coal companies were allowed to be self-insured, that any kind of damage, environmental damage, they would pay for themselves. However, a lot of these coal companies are filing bankruptcy and basically walking away from their environmental responsibilities.
All right, let's see. Suzanne, is this something that you're...
I don't know specifically about the coal, but I do know barges do have the right-of-way on the Missouri River. The Coast Guard actually deals with any type of emergency response, but that is a thing. If you are recreationally out on the river, you do need to make way for the barges. I know during the Missouri River 340 that barges will... in the past, they've tried to work around that race because they understand that mm-hmm. it is... you know, an important time for, that event has created enough interest. But yeah, the Coast Guard oversees any emergency response, and I believe they, if you're moving certain types of product, you need to have an emergency response plan that is in line with the Corps of Engineers. That's my understanding.
All right. I want to get quickly back to recreation. A recent piece of proposed legislation in Missouri is being interpreted as a threat to recreation along the river. And currently, people wanting to, say, camp along the river are allowed to do so beginning at the high water mark. This legislation would make it so that recreation isn't allowed beyond the low water mark. And because you can't camp in the water, at least not as of now, humans haven't quite evolved that way, people who like to go on multi-day canoe trips and such aren't loving this idea. Mandy Urban, how would this affect the river race you participate in, the MR340?
Well, due to the fact that the race is a nonstop paddle race, there are times when people will have to stop and rest, and that'll happen anywhere along the river, anywhere along the river. So that would really affect sometimes the safety of a person participating in that race. If there's not a spot for them to stop and rest, then, you know, they're risking even more when they're out there racing.
The legislation also deems all waterways unnavigable unless a Missouri court has actively determined that a specific waterway is navigable. How does that differ from the current situation?
Explain that again for me.
Well, I guess they want it to be that a waterway is unnavigable unless officially declared to be navigable. So you, yeah, I don't know if you're looking into whether waterways are navigable before you attempt to navigate them, or if that's a distinction that that you worry
about.
I
consider any waterway navigable, but and I know a lot of recreational paddlers do, you know, want to get out there and try to see all these different waterways. Navigable meaning like the Missouri River.
I think that might be a core term. There's certain navigable channels. Like, for example, you know, getting back to the Arkansas River, the entire Arkansas River is not a navigable channel by core terms. The McClellan Kerr Navigation Channel, which is a set up distance between so many river miles, is considered a navigation channel. I'm guessing that's kind of what that refers to.
Uh-huh. If I could jump in.
Yeah, please, Rick.
I think part of that controversy also comes about with the farmers and other landowners battling with the Corps of Engineers over their jurisdiction of waters in the U.S. and also some EPA efforts to regulate waters in the U.S.
Exactly.
And the Missouri sets off kind of a discussion about what they should be regulating, what type of water.
Yeah, the Missouri rep who proposed the legislation was apparently motivated by what he sees as overreach on the part of the EPA. And Rick, I was going to ask you, as a farmer, is that something that concerns you?
It doesn't concern me here. I don't have a problem with it here. But I know farmers in other areas, places, say in Pennsylvania or in eastern states where there are higher populations, or in places like North Dakota and South Dakota where they have prairie potholes that are sort of seasonal ponds that rainfall fills up low places that dry up later on in the year. And they're really concerned about it because the EPA can be very aggressive in the way they regulate all kinds of things, from erosion to drainage of wet spots, all kinds of things. And really it's concerning to farmers because those fines could just be devastating to a small family farm when they're levied.
So, Rick, one of the perhaps unintended consequences of the proposed legislation would be to affect people like Mandy camping along the riverbanks at night. Does that sort of behavior, camping along riverbanks, does that hurt farmers in any way, or is that just unrelated for you?
I think anytime we have these battles over government jurisdiction, and a lot of that, I think, comes about as a result of citizen groups, farm groups, recreation groups, conservation groups, And so we all lobby Congress for what we want, and that sort of sets that off. And then we have to try to find some high ground together, and everybody cluster up on that, on something that we can agree on. I think that's where a lot of that government regulation stuff comes from initially, is from citizen groups who have something they want, and so they lobby Congress to get it.
Well, Rick Oswald, farmer from the Fairfax Langdon area, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate having the opportunity.
And just so you know, Larry Rizzo from the Department of Conservation just called to correct something Rick said earlier. Rick said that the Department of Conservation doesn't pay taxes when it acquires land. And Larry Rizzo tells us that the Department of Conservation does make payments in lieu of taxes to the county when it acquires farmland. Mandy Urban, river recreation enthusiast, thank you.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to have to come back to this conversation about the Missouri River and its future, both real and imagined, after this break. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Reporter Suzanne Hogan is with me, and we're talking about the future of the Missouri River. We don't all interact with the river very often, but we do have opinions about it. I know you do. And not just opinions, fantasies for what could make that river awesome. We've been hearing your dreams at 816-235-2888 and getting feedback from people who use the river a lot, a farmer, a paddler, and now a guy named Timothy Amundson. Hi, Timothy.
Hi, Gina.
You are the founder of a project you're calling the Turkey Creek Institute for Phenomenal Awareness, but that probably isn't exactly clear just on the face of it what it is to most of our listeners. Explain your relationship to the river, what it is you're doing.
Well, the project dealing with Turkey Creek has been an investigation into kind of a locational style of research that's consisted of going to Turkey Creek and investigating a waterway from that perspective, talking to people on the ground. And then
people who live and work right around there.
Yeah, and people who have memories there, people who have stories there. And then also just gathering perceptually a lot of information, and through dialogue and meditation and all sorts of different ways you can interact, exploration, kind of gathering up a sense of what a waterway is in this new century and how we can imagine things have changed and become the way that they are right now.
So. Have you had an aha moment in this process that has really surprised you about just how we, as you said, in this new century relate to water?
Yeah, I think that there's something deeply embedded in us that we don't always grasp. It sounds like people and everybody who's talked about going to the river has some sense of that. There's like some other majesty or something we feel, or how Matthew was talking about it being this kind of like other thing that provides us with power. And I think what I've seen with people that has been a prolonged, ongoing aha moment as I've taken a lot of people down to Turkey Creek is that something happens where the kind of like the grid, I like to call it, you know, the cell phone and the driving and the shopping and all that kind of modern life world kind of slips away, and some people wake up and they look kind of like babies. Aww. You know, they just like wake up and they're smiling and they're just taken by the environment, by the sounds. And that's in a very urban kind of blighted ecosystem, with relatively poor water quality and a lot of sound pollution and trash everywhere. And you can still have that kind of an effect.
Do you spend time on the Missouri River?
I've spent a good deal of time on the Missouri River. Less so than Turkey Creek as of lately, just because it's been such a huge focus for me. But the Missouri has a definite purpose in my life. So for a certain kind of experiential desire that might come across for me, and I would feel that something drawing me to the Missouri River, yeah, there's a purpose for it. I've especially enjoyed canoeing on it and kind of going down and looking at the different kinds of environments, whether it's, you know, old industrial zones like along the Blue River confluence, or you know, some lost wilderness like down off Front Street. If you kind of go along down there, actually, that's where Turkey Creek used to dump into the Blue River and the Missouri back in the Pleistocene. And if you go down Front Street down there, it's a really amazing environment full of turkey and pheasant and skunks, and I've seen all sorts.
And that's on the banks then?
It's kind of, yeah, there's like a weird little left alone spot. I'm really interested in those interstitial urban areas where things have been left just by whatever litigation anomaly or whatever, where you end up with these kind of spaces that can then start to thrive again as places for non-human kinds of things. That's one thing that...
So you like to kind of go tiptoeing through those areas as a lone human?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is one thing that I've been thinking throughout this entire show, is that we've talked almost exclusively about the needs of humans and what the river provides humans, whether it's politically, economically, food, travel, recreation. I mean, these are all human needs, and humans are very new to this environment in the grand scheme of this planet, and this kind of influence that humans have had, this kind of interaction, is a blip on this universal timescale. And in the last 100 years, we've made such an effect on the ability for other forms of life to utilize the river in the ways that it's necessary for them, that it's evolutionarily essential for things like turkey and deer and, you know, all these other terrestrial animals and aquatic beings to be able to use the river.
What do you hope the river could be?
I mean, there's various levels of dreaming that are possible. I could see a more realistic kind of dreaming like we've talked about, where everybody's happy, but really, truly, if I'm allowed to dream...
Yeah, you're allowed.
I've been obsessed with this idea of a floodplain buyout, which was suggested in an Army Corps document that I saw. And the idea of that, they kind of shoot it down as they bring up the idea. But the idea would be that if you could buy out the entire floodplain, then you could allow it to do what it really does. And so after I have that idea, then I came up with this kind of like little joke proposal for my style of flood control, which I would call Leave It to Beaver. So I think that like rewilding is one of the most amazing potentials that hasn't really been given much of a chance, especially in the Midwest. And I think that radical rewilding of the river could be an amazing thing that would allow us to coexist with all sorts of abundant life.
Suzanne Hogan, very quickly, Timothy's project is all about awareness of the river. Do you think that that is important for the future of the Missouri River, no matter how it's shaped or decided?
Oh, for sure, definitely. I mean, the more we interact with it and remember that it's there and it's the reason why we are in Kansas City, I think that we forget that we live on this amazing river. So.
That's all the time we have today. I'd like to thank Suzanne Hogan, a KCUR reporter who often covers stories on nature and environment. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thanks, Gina.
And thank you, Timothy Amundsen from the Turkey Creek Institute for Phenomenal Awareness.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Suzanne, Gina, for having me on. Caught me off guard.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for joining us. Right. And if you missed any of today's show, we'll have it online for you by the end of the day, kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also find Suzanne's story on industry along the river at kcur.org. Tomorrow, we'll have a food show all about ice cream. Hard to beat that. I personally can't wait. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.
Little girl down on the strand with that pretty little baby.